today we celebrate this very exciting feast day. We really do. This is the dedication of the Lateran Basilica. The Lateran Basilica is the Basilica of St. John Lateran in Rome. Now, every diocese has what's called a cathedral in the sense that it's where the bishop sort of takes his seat, as they actually describe it. They literally describe it as the bishop's seat is in the cathedral. That's not to be confused with cathedral-style architecture, which is something else altogether. And if you want to get into a discussion on art and architecture, I'm happy to do that at a later time. But this is to address that every diocese has one cathedral that is the bishop's seat, where the bishop actually is the pastor, and he appoints a rector, a caretaker, to look after him while he's not there for its day-to-day concerns. In the Diocese of Rome, John Lateran is their cathedral. Now, they have lots of cathedral-style buildings. They have lots of basilicas, which is a specific kind of church. But John Lateran is the church in Rome. What's very impressive about this is, well, there's several things that are actually very impressive about it. First and foremost, it is the oldest church in Christendom. It's the first Catholic church ever dedicated. And it was dedicated in the year 300. Not exactly 300, 300 and something. I don't remember off the top of my head, but it was consecrated by Pope Sylvester. If you're looking for a new name for your next kid, I'm telling you right now, Pope Sylvester was a great guy. It's a great name. But Pope Sylvester dedicated the very first church in Christendom, and it was this basilica, not in its current form or in its current glory. It was actually much smaller the first time it was consecrated. But it was consecrated on the land that continues to be the land donated by the Lateran family. The Lateran family was very powerful, very influential families in the city of Rome, and they actually dedicated all of their land to be given to the church for this particular church. If you ever get a chance to see it today, in its current state is the way it was rededicated in the 1600s by Pope Clement X, who actually also had the capstone at it, the mother and source of all other churches. It is the model in so many ways, and it's a great reminder of what our faith is. And not in the sense that it's a building. Because the building can be destroyed. Come to think of it, John Lateran's been destroyed on several occasions, not completely, but severely damaged to the point where you might as well scrap it and start over. It's been severely damaged on many occasions. But our faith isn't the building. It's a reminder of where we come from, of what we're doing. If you ever get a chance to see this incredible basilica, it is enormous. I was describing it to the servers just before Mass. I was in the Lateran Basilica when I was about 14 years old. And walking through the main body of the church are statues of all the apostles. And that sounds impressive, and you might think statue, like the statue we have here. But that's a little misleading. The statues of the apostles in the Lateran Basilica are between 20 and 30 feet tall. They are made entirely of stone, and they are massive column-like structures, each of them standing with a presence and a size that just, it's humbling to stand in front of. And there are 12 of them. They actually form the main 12 naves, or the main 12 columns that form the structure of the main body of the church. It's that reminder, just as the scriptures tell us, that we are the living stones of this church. It's not the stone itself. The stone can be destroyed. We can build another building. It's us. It's that reminder that Christ set up the church as this very present and amazing thing. And the church is so amazing for its sacraments, for this great gift of what it is offered within these sacraments, these beautiful and incredible opportunities to come to Christ. You know, as you walk down the main body of the church, it's incredible. It's huge. I can't even begin to describe it to you. And yet I'm going to try. So here, I mean, we come down and you not only see these incredible apostles, but each of them hold the implements by which they were martyred. They show some horrifying images in one sense. St. Andrew stands with a saw that in modern terms would be referred to as a widowmaker for cutting down trees. It is this massive saw. He holds it above his shoulder. It goes all the way to the length of the floor by his feet. It is this enormous awe because he was cut in half. St. Bartholomew holds this huge something in his hand, and I thought it was like a garment or something. It was enormous, and I couldn't figure it out. And I asked someone, what is that he's holding? They said, oh, don't you know? St. Bartholomew was flayed alive. That's his skin. He doesn't look so bad in a statue, but you know, he stands there with this. And there's this powerful reminder that each of these apostles gave incredible witness to their faith. They stood for something. They stood for something truly remarkable. If you head through the main body of the church, you come to this enormous baldacchino with a great altar, it's impressive. And only the Pope says Mass there. And there are at least 25 other altars where other priests say Mass. It's the nature of a basilica. It has multiple altars. What is truly, truly remarkable is this structure is so large that it's almost as long as it is wide. It's kind of T-shaped. And if you go through the full body of the church and you go off to the left, it's a huge hall because we've had five councils there. There have been five ecumenical councils where the bishop gathered together. You know, we talk about Vatican I and Vatican II. They used to be called Lateran. Lateran I, Lateran II, Lateran III, Lateran IV, Lateran V. We're very creative, you can tell. Five Lateran councils. And at the heart, all the way on the far wall, it's sectioned off. You can't go over there. But there's this one little table. And in this massive structure, it looks absolutely tiny. It looks almost insignificant. And it sits off to one side. This could be a huge table. It could be twice the size of an altar for all I know. But it sits in such a large space that it looks so very small. And I read the instruction. It was an engraving. It said, that table goes all the way back to the first century. And Mass was said on that table all those centuries ago. And they think, they don't know for sure, but they think St. Peter said Mass at that altar. Not literally in that space, they moved it into that church. But it's that reminder, that connection that goes all the way back, that our faith is this enormously important thing in our life. And I find this such a powerful moment for us as we come together to celebrate the dedication of the Lateran Basilica. Because it isn't just some big grandiose thing. It isn't just celebrating some big fancy church. Although I do have to say, if you get a chance, don't pass on an opportunity to see the Basilica of St. John Lateran. In the 16th century, it was actually rededicated to St. John the Baptist, which is why it's called St. John's. And they call it John Lateran because the Lateran family donated all the land. Remember, if you ever think you're donating a lot to the church, if you've donated enough land and enough building materials to build a basilica, then you've matched the Lateran family. So, you know, just keep that in mind. It's just a little joke. I'm teasing. But it's worthy of considering, especially as we reflect on these readings. There's just something truly remarkable about this because we have this incredible instance of Jesus. We have this incredible instance where Jesus comes out and he shows wonderful zeal. He comes into the temple area. The temple area is a place of sacrifice. A place of sacrifice that happens on an ongoing and regular basis. Remember, we have a great gift in the fact that we have many, many, many Catholic churches where the sacrifice is ongoing. Where we celebrate this truly remarkable moment where Christ sacrificed himself for us. But in the temple, that was the only temple. Any sacrifice made by the people of God, the Jewish people of God, had to be made at that temple. No matter where you live, if you had to make a sacrifice to God, if you had to make that offering, you had to make the pilgrimage to go to Jerusalem, to go to that temple to make that offering. And in that offering, in that temple, in that space, they need a lot of offerings. They need oxen and sheep and turtle doves and pigeons. They need those. But you see, the temple has many sections. There's that front outer area where lots of things go on. But the challenge and the nature of what they had done is they had moved all of these animals, these livestock, this marketplace, and they had moved it into just in front of the place of sacrifice. Not only that, but they had the money changers there. Well, what are the money changers there for? Well, you see, when you make a pilgrimage to the temple, you had to pay the temple tax. But the temple tax was not in local currency. whatever currency you were using, whether you were from the Greek-controlled areas or the Roman-controlled areas, it didn't use that currency. It used its own special temple currency. So you had to take whatever money you had, and you had to go into the exchange rate. And anyone who's ever gone into a bank and tried to do a proper exchange of money knows that it's always a headache, and the coins never seem to add up properly. Well, that's what the money changers were there for, was they had to do all this math out and make sure that everything happened correctly, so that they got their proper coins, so that they could pay their temple tax, so that they could make their visit. And all of these things, they suddenly took precedence over the sacrifice itself. They lost sight. They lost perspective. They lost what it was they were there for. Instead of being the temple, the place of God where they were supposed to come in to receive God, to offer their sacrifice, to make this prayer, to have this particular connection to God on earth, they'd lost it. And instead, it had been turned into anything else. A place of commerce, a place of indifference, a place where just the day-to-day life went on. But it's holy ground. Consecrated, particular, sacred. And as we celebrate this Lateran Basilica's feast day, as we celebrate this incredible celebration of the dedication of the very first church in Christendom, we're reminded of two things. The first is that each of us is a temple of the Holy Spirit. As one of my brother priests pointed out, some of us are working on basilicas, but we're all temples of the Holy Spirit, consecrated to God. That means the body is holy. And how we treat the body is relevant and important. We can't just say, well, it's my body, I can do with it whatever I want. It's more than that. It's holy. And we should respect that holiness. The second thing that it addresses, and it's something very important that comes to us in the modern world. Today, in the modern world, we encounter so often the challenge to be good Christians. We're challenged to be good Christians in so many ways, and one of the very popular ones when I was growing up was the bracelets that went around that said, WWJD, what would Jesus do? And it became this great cry, what would Jesus do? What would Jesus do? What would Jesus do? And finally, one day, I started to get really upset. The person stood in front of me and said, wait, what would Jesus do? And I said, you know what? Sometimes Jesus grabs a whip and clears house. We really can attach this idea of mercy and love, and those are beautiful things, and they are a part of who God is. But never underestimate that there is holy fervor, and that when we encounter injustice, when we encounter things that are not going the way that they're supposed to, when we encounter something that isn't right, we have to respond if we are to be true Christians. The modern world has challenged us to this, and we went from what would Jesus do to something that frightens me even more. Comes back to a statement where I hear all too often, that people say to me, wait, you're a Christian. Who are you to judge me? And I have to pause. Because I think for a moment, I think, well, that is a worthy question. Who am I to judge? But what does that mean? What does it mean to judge? If we speak of it philosophically, judgments are when we determine the goodness or badness of a thing. Every time we encounter something, whether it's fruit or a poisonous viper, we judge the goodness or badness of the thing. I look at a snake and I think, probably shouldn't get too close to that. I look at a banana and I think, I want a banana. I make a judgment. I make a judgment. Sometimes I'll see it and I'll go up to it and I'll want it. I see chocolate cake and I think, chocolate cake. Then I eat it. It's good. I see a cobra, I think, not good, I'm going away. These are judgments we make. Wait a minute, who am I to judge? Actually, I am someone to judge. The judgment that we're told to be very careful of, the judgment that we're warned of our sinful behavior, the judgment that we are told not to do, is to make the final judgment. A final determination that says that any particular person has no more hope for salvation. When I look at my neighbor and I think, man, my neighbor drives me crazy, and they do all these bad things, and they're just terrible, and they don't respect my property, and they don't respect anyone else's property. They're just terrible people. Obviously, there's no helping them anymore. I'm just giving up on them, and they'll probably go to hell. That's a wrong judgment.
Because they're also temples of the Holy Spirit. And they are also children of God. And so they always, always have hope for salvation. But if I look at an addict and I say, that's wrong, they question, who am I to judge? The answer is, I'm a Christian with morals, and my judgment comes from my faith that has moral decisions, that implies and asserts and makes clear that there are good things to do in life and there are bad things to do in life. And if you disagree with me, I ask you one simple question. Let's take an extreme. Is killing people wrong? I hope you think say yes. I hope we can honestly all agree that the direct taking of someone's life is wrong. Is stealing wrong? I hope we can say yes. We have morals. We say that things are right and wrong. Now, here's the difference. We can say, who am I to judge? And the answer is, I'm a person who holds to morals. Does that mean I do it perfectly every time myself? I didn't say that. Does that mean that person has no hope for salvation? Nope. Does that mean that person should be cast out? I didn't say that either. Did that mean that we should mistreat that person or treat them less because they're not doing something right? I never said that. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. We are always called to love. We are always called to show that love and to share that love with each and every person that we encounter and to be loving. But we do judge actions, not people. We can judge actions for good or bad, for right or wrong, for goodness or badness, rightness and wrongness. We make those judgments because we are all called to be held to a moral standard. And when the moral standard exists, there is right and wrong. We judge those actions. And if we find a purple person committing a bad action, that doesn't mean that they are necessarily an evil person. They're just a person who we want to make better choices. When your children make bad choices, do you tell them, well, who am I to judge? When was the last time you saw a three-year-old take a metal knife, decide to stick it in an electric socket and say, who am I to judge? Maybe they want to electrocute themselves. No, we do something. We get out there, we say, no, don't do that. You'll hurt yourself. You don't let your children stick their hand in a pot of boiling water either, I hope. Why? Because it's going to hurt them. We've made a decision. We've made a judgment. And I call you to one more thing. I know the Pope has been often quoted, over and over again. Wait a minute, Father. Didn't the Pope say, who am I to judge? My answer is very simple. That's only half of his sentence. The full quote, as it was translated, is, who am I to judge them if they are seeking the Lord in good faith? And that's a very necessary part of that sentence. We don't cast anybody out. We don't count anybody as lost. The Pope reminds us that each and every person should be invited by the love of God to live that witness to love. But just like the Pope gives this example, we invite them in and we show them our joy, our gospel way of life, our good news. Because in that good news, we have an example of what is good. And we strive for that good with everything that we do. And we want to give other people that example of that good. It's not that we want to keep people out. It's never, ever about trying to make someone feel small or separated or sidelined. Never. But we want to strive for the good. We want to encourage the good. We need to teach the good. And should someone ask, who are you to judge? Well, my answer is this. I am a sinful man with weaknesses and failings and shortcomings. But I'm working on it. And I'm trying to make the other people around me better as well. I am not perfect. But that doesn't mean I can't encourage what's good.
and reject what's bad. What would Jesus do? Jesus would want you to do the right thing. Sometimes the right thing isn't the easy thing, but it's always the thing that leads us back to God.